Governor Doug Ducey this week said his administration would start posting names, photos, and other info of deadbeat dads. But could this strategy backfire?
Shaming, in a general sense, in the Western world could lead to internalization of a label. The behavior, rather than being curtailed, may be amplified.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, has the Valley's wet and cold January affected its economy? The latest on harassment allegations at Grand Canyon National Park.
Downtown Phoenix is working to attract new tech firms.
As higher education's role evolves, do honorary degrees still matter?
And turning down trees into furniture.
In an urban environment, there's so many species that I've never seen before as lumber. So some of it's unknown potential, where I see a log and think, that could be really cool.
Plus, some of the world's most storied instruments are coming to the Valley.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today will become partly cloudy sometime this evening, when we'll expect overnight lows to be in the lower to mid-40s. For tomorrow, partly cloudy again with a high of 62. We'll start the weekend off on Saturday with partly cloudy skies and a high of 64. It's currently mostly sunny and 59 degrees at KJZZ. There is one accident on the freeways to tell you about. It's I-10 westbound at 35th Avenue.
This week, utility regulators in Nevada upheld recent changes to the rate structure for residential rooftop solar. The move is causing outrage among customers and an exodus of solar businesses. KJZZ's Will Stone reports some Arizona policymakers are taking note.
Nevada is hemorrhaging hundreds of solar jobs as companies leave the state. Last month, the Public Utilities Commission decided to raise monthly fees for those with rooftop solar by 40%, while at the same time scaling back what customers are paid for sending power back to the grid. Later this year, Arizona regulators will take up a much-anticipated rate case for the state's largest utility, APS. The recent debate over net metering here has been combative at times, but Corporation Commissioner Tom Farese believes Arizona can avoid what he calls the zero-sum game in Nevada.
The problem is the premise. We're talking about who's going to pay what cost. And I think there's a different way to look into it. We can leverage technology and we can use a spirit of diplomacy.
Recently, Farese has been meeting with executives from both solar and utilities to help reset the conversation. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A rate case for Arizona Public Service solar customers is expected later this year, and some regulators here are taking note of the fallout in Nevada. Corporation Commissioner Tom Farese says he believes utilities and the solar industry will be able to chart a different course, though.
I think that the choices that they had to make were unfortunate. But I'd like to see, in comparing ourselves to Nevada, is to put ourselves in a different position where it isn't zero sum.
Recently, the commission has been meeting with executives from both industries to help reset the conversation.
This week, the Federal Office of Inspector General released a report confirming that National Park Service employees in the Grand Canyon preyed on their female co-workers, demanding sex and punishing women who refused. The report was prompted by a 2014 complaint by 13 employees alleging a pattern of abuse on river trips that lasted 15 years. Now, some of those victims are speaking out. The women in this story did not wish to use their real names because of concerns for their own safety. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
Miles below the rim of the Grand Canyon, deep in the wilderness, on river trips lasting weeks at a time, teams of National Park Service workers, supervisors, researchers, boatmen, and law enforcement manage public safety in the canyon's wildlife and archaeological sites. Often, satellite phones are their only connection to the outside world.
I mean, that's one of the beauties of it, is that you're in a wilderness environment and you are isolated and you feel completely removed from the world. But when you're starting to talk about feeling unsafe, it did feel very scary to know that you were basically stuck in a situation.
That's the way this woman, an intern, felt when a boatman put a camera up her skirt and took a picture. On the same night, she says a second boatman threatened another woman with an axe, yelling profanities.
Basically, things to the effect of, you need to keep your mouth shut, you need to not report this. There was alcohol involved, and I think that that amped up the situation indeed, but that was a very terrifying moment.
A female supervisor on the trip did report the camera incident, and that boatman was suspended for 30 days. He later quit. But this was only one incident of many. Another complainant worked as a river ranger from 2009 to 2012. She and another government employee were on duty, sober, in the middle of the day.
We were on a boat together. We were with, you know, several boats. He asked me to pull over and separated us from the group. He exposed his genitalia to me and propositioned me for sex. There were three supervisors on that trip. And I went and told, a supervisor what happened, and he didn't do anything.
She says she didn't make a formal complaint at the time.
You know, this was a good old boy club, and you felt like, you know, I relied on those guys to have my back. And if I flipped a boat, I was like, I can't make a formal complaint against them.
In addition to the 13 whistleblowers, the OIG report found 22 other employees at Grand Canyon who say they witnessed or experienced sexual harassment and hostile work environments. Because a job in the Grand Canyon is highly coveted, many say they just put up with the abuse. Here's a river guide who was contracted by the park.
So at the time, I was really afraid of coming forward that I might lose my big chance of working in the Grand Canyon.
The report confirms that when women refused advances or complained, they were shamed, denied food on trips, or simply ignored. The Park Service did take action in many cases. They prohibited alcohol on river trips, issued written reprimands to some employees, and suspended or terminated others. Still, it didn't solve the problem.
I know that in my situation, somebody was reprimanded. I think he got 10 days off, which to me sounds like more of a vacation rather than a reprimand. But the fact that he continued to work there for the last 16 years continuing to do this, I don't understand that.
National Park Service spokesman James Doyle says as a result of this report, the Grand Canyon will be making many changes in coming months.
The National Park Service has zero tolerance for the behavior described in the OIG report. This is absolutely unacceptable to us on every level, and we're working, starting now, to change the culture there.
Doyle says some disciplinary action has been taken and more will be taken. In the OIG report, at least one boatman, called Boatman 3, was repeatedly named in complaints, but still had his job. Here's the second woman, the river ranger.
We want it to stop. I mean, we want a workplace free of sexual harassment, free of violence. We would like people held accountable. We would like people, you know, repeat offenders, you know, their positions terminated. You can't have change if you just keep giving these guys, that's not zero tolerance, you're giving these guys multiple chances.
Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
In the middle of explaining his plans for K-12 education, a border security force, and water in Arizona, Governor Doug Ducey also introduced his own version of the Scarlet Letter during his State of the State address.
Some people have referred to me as the hashtag governor. Well, here's a new one for all the deadbeat dads out there. Effective immediately, the state is going to begin posting the photos, names, and money owed by these losers to social media.
With me to talk about the concept of public shaming is John Gurney, lecturer in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at ASU. John, has this been done before when it comes to deadbeat parents?
I know of no precedent for shaming, quote-unquote, deadbeat parents. What I do know, though, is that with regard to shaming in a general sense, the process of shaming goes back thousands of years in various forms. When we look at sort of this modern trend in shaming, what we see, though, really falls into two main camps. The first is shaming by judges sort of as an alternative sanction. That may be something where we shame an offender by making them stand on a street corner wearing a sign or something like that. Another big way that shaming is used is when we see it through things like Megan's Law, where we register sex offenders and we put the public on notice that sex offenders live in their neighborhoods, for example.
We often think about recidivistic behavior, and is it possible that doing something like this could prevent a repeat performance, for example? Now, is it possible that shaming could lead to something like that, this idea that, well, I really am embarrassed by having this called out, so that might make it less likely I'll commit this same violation in the future?
That is possible, and you raise a very valid point. Some of the literature that I've reviewed suggests that shaming practices have more efficacy in Eastern cultures, not so much in the Western world. The reason being is that in Eastern cultures, it's typically they're more communal, and it's more based around the thought process of what the family will think of me, what my friends will think of me. In the Western world, I think it's a safe statement to say that we are a more individualistic type of people. And so the shaming process probably has different results depending on the culture and the particular culture where we're utilizing the shaming. So I think if we speak of shaming sort of in our country or in a broader sense in the Western world, it may not have the same degree of efficacy that we might expect if we had it, say, in the Eastern world, where there's more of a focus on community and things are more communal in nature. In fact, I would submit from the literature that I'm aware of that shaming in a general sense in the Western world could lead to internalization of a label. And then there's a whole process that goes on once the label is internalized. And we call that the dramatization of the evil. And then that leads to something that criminologists and sociologists call deviance amplification, which means that the behavior, rather than being curtailed, may be amplified.
Because perhaps the person feels like, I don't have much left to lose anyway. Someone's already taken away my dignity.
Exactly.
I imagine there must be some people who aren't paying child support because they simply can't afford it, not because they're necessarily trying to violate a judge's order. Could that end up being something where people who are lower income are getting extra punishment, where others maybe could hire an attorney to help them, whatnot?
It seems that is a realistic probability. You know, I was just reading an article, and I can't remember who made this quote, so I apologize for that. But the person who was quoted in the article suggested that this is not about deadbeat parents, but it's about dead broke parents. Mm-hmm. And if this is something that's attacking a class of people, i.e. those parents who are living in a state of poverty or unemployed, or for that matter, even underemployed, this could be viewed as sort of a class-based warfare kind of attack. I'm not sure that at this point we can make that assessment.
What do you think the best outcome of this could be?
Looking at this, I guess the only metric that I can see is that we get at least a fair proportion of these individuals who are shamed to come forward and to begin paying. But I'm not optimistic about that because I think there's a reason that they're in that predicament to begin with. One of the other things, too, is I think that with respect to the individuals who are on this list, the shaming list, I'm not certain that we can even track them down. Their address may not even be known. I'm not all that optimistic that shaming them on Facebook or Twitter will have an appreciable effect.
John Gurney of the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at ASU, we've been talking about shaming. John, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
Sky Harbor has gotten 1.13 inches of rain so far this month. That's almost 3/4 of an inch more than average by this day. And the valley has seen some below average high temperatures in January, not to mention fog on the mountains and frost on windshields. In an area known as a good place to get away from winter, is that hurting the region's economy? To find out, I'm joined by Valley economist Elliot Pollack, who runs Elliott D. Pollack & Company. Elliot, has the kind of winter-like weather affected our economy?
I really don't think so. I think it's negligible. The effect on the region would be if tourists come out and say, boy, the weather really isn't good, and so we're not going back. And that is possible, but more likely, for example, the people who came out for the Alabama-Clemson game probably thought the weather was just fine relative to what they're used to this time of year. So I'm not sure that it would really be a negative experience. The weather would almost have to change permanently or for an extended period of time for it to have any major impact. I don't think it would have much of an effect on tourism. It might have delayed some retail sales where people say, you know, I don't think I'm going to go shopping today. I don't want to drive in this weather. But I think it's a postponement. It's not a cancellation of retail sales.
Do you think that it's possible that the cold might be, or relative cold for us, might be less important than something like rain? I mean, it's either sunny or it's not sunny. People who are coming here either for a big event or just to escape winter in the Northeast or the Midwest or the South, if it's raining here, that's probably not what they're coming for.
Well, the rain is probably a bigger impediment than the cold because, again, relative to people coming from the Midwest and the East, the 50s is still not bad. And now it's back in the 60s, and this is summer for them. The rain, on the other hand, prevents them not only from getting sunshine, but it probably inhibits them from going shopping and really enjoying what they came out to enjoy. So I agree. I think that the rain would have more of an impact.
Do you think that it has any kind of effect on construction, other industries like that, where folks maybe can't get out and do the kind of work that they normally would be doing because of the weather?
Well, yes, it does. Obviously, if you're at a construction site and you're working on something that is not enclosed yet, it's going to have an impact. If you're trying to lay cement for a driveway, for example, or put in a foundation, it's going to have an effect. But the effect is to postpone rather than cancel. And so what will happen is these people will be working overtime when the sun starts to shine again.
So do you think it's fair to say then that anything that is different this year will only be different in that the time that it's happening as opposed to what's actually happening?
Well, I think in terms of the impact it has, it will affect the timing of when people do things rather than if they do things. The rain might affect tourists' ability to spend more than anything else. But again, I think that is fairly normal. This year we have a little more rain than normal. Some years we have no rain. I think it tends to even out over time. But I think there will be an impact, but I think it will be negligible this year.
Valley economist Elliot Pollack is CEO of the firm Elliott D. Pollack & Company. Coming up, what's it going to take to bring your company into the urban core? Maybe it's the people.
You know, there's 80 million people in the United States that are now millennials, and we thought that they were going to follow their folks, the baby boomers, out to the suburbs, and it hasn't happened.
Tech companies are going where the workers are. That's just ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. With Mark, I'm Steve. It is the show on 91.5 KJZZ. Valley traffic pretty light so far this afternoon. There is one accident to watch out for, though. It's I-10 westbound at Queen Creek Road, and that has the off-ramp restricted. We'll stay mostly sunny through the rest of this afternoon and become partly cloudy tonight with lows in the lower 40s, partly cloudy again tomorrow with a high around 63. Currently with relative humidity at 31%, we have mostly clear skies, 62 degrees at KJZZ at 221.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership featuring the all-new 2016 Outback, 33 mpg fuel efficiency and built for your active lifestyle. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
Which came first, the businesses or the millennials? When it comes to the rapid development going on in downtown Phoenix, the answer may not matter.
Startup and technology companies have been flocking to the city center along with the young professionals they want to hire. The show's Lauren Gilger stopped by one tech startup's new downtown offices to see what's happening.
No cubicles, it's all one big office space.
At the new offices of startup tech company Yazimo, young professionals click away at Apple computers in a high-ceilinged, loft-like room lined with big windows.
Natural light was huge for us.
One employee Skypes with a client next to the requisite beanbags and a big-screen TV.
The way we have our desks bunched is they're in groups of about five, so we have five desks next to each other.
And Lindsay Ingles' Mastiff Boxer Mix, named Reagan, follows her as she shows me the 3,000-square-foot office the company moved into last year in the historic Heard Building downtown.
There's no spaces between us, so I'm sitting right next to, you know, one of my colleagues. I can see her screen, she can see my screens. It's all about open communication for us.
Yazimo was started by two Arizona State University students 4 years ago. They specialize in lead generation, which means they create Facebook quizzes that you click on, take, and then put your name and email address in to see the results.
That name and email gets added to our client's list, so we're creating a lead for them, just somebody that they can market to and sell their products to.
Now, with 9 full-time employees, they expect to triple in size this year. Ingles says this new open space and its downtown location is important.
We found that just by looking for new employees in the past couple of months, that you tell them that we're in downtown, like, oh my gosh, that's so cool, I can light rail for my interview. It's one of the first things that we hear from people, is cool, I can light rail. cool, I don't have to worry about parking. And it really has drawn in people our age.
The oldest person working at Yazimo is 27. And these young, educated millennials are exactly who businesses are trying to attract, according to David Kreider, president of Community Development Group Downtown Phoenix, Inc.
So we're standing in the Heard Building. So this is one of the oldest buildings and one of the original high-rises in downtown Phoenix. And it's being redeveloped as essentially an office building for tech and design and creative companies.
Yazimo moved into the building's fourth floor. Architecture firm Winslow & Partners moved in recently, and they just announced Booking.com will open an office there soon.
We're getting a lot of interest from those types of firms in downtown Phoenix because they're basically following the people.
Downtown Phoenix, like other major cities across the country, is experiencing a sea change right now, Kreider says.
You know, there's 80 million people in the United States that are now millennials. The largest age cohorts in the United States are all in their 20s. And unanticipated by a lot of us that have been involved in redevelopment for a long time, it's become an increasingly urban generation. We thought that they were going to follow their folks, the baby boomers, out to the suburbs, and it hasn't happened.
That demographic shift, along with 12,000 students from ASU and the University of Arizona, a trailblazing arts community, a few sports stadiums, and the light rail, and you've got the ingredients for a truly urban center, according to Kreider.
You know, the other thing you see going on downtown is this tremendous housing boom that wasn't anticipated, where you've got literally 2,000 units of new, you know, residential getting built within downtown. I mean, who would have thought, you know, even, you know, 5-7 years ago that that was going to happen?
2015 saw a wave of technology companies and startups, including Uber, head downtown. The historic Lohr's building was just renovated and brought in venture company Tallwave to launch a startup incubator. The city of Phoenix reports 12,000 tech jobs were added here from 2012 to 2014, and their business program encourages building owners to rethink traditional office space and make their buildings more attractive to these tech companies.
One of the big reasons why we wanted to move downtown is we wanted to be around people like us.
But attracting millennials apparently hinges on one thing. Is it cool now?
Like, something I heard the other day is Phoenix is becoming the new Austin. It's like the new Austin, Texas, and how it's like growing, and there's live music you can go to every night in downtown, and there's restaurants, and just the atmosphere is really cool.
And that cool factor is what David Kreider says has been a long time coming.
I think that there was a lot of skepticism about if this place, the most suburban of metropolitan areas in the United States, could ever develop an urban core. And I think everybody now, 100% believes that. You can see and feel that every day.
It's The Show. I'm Lauren Gilger.
One industry that's trying to get a toehold here is cybersecurity. Ori Eisen is the CEO and founder of the startup firm Trusona and a board member of Security Canyon, a cybersecurity coalition. Ori, what is this group set up to do?
It is set up to do four things, but mainly attract and retain cybersecurity talent here in town. We have an issue where a lot of companies want to grow here, but there's no one to give the jobs to. A lot of students who study here at ASU, as soon as they get their degree, they go to another state or go to Silicon Valley, and they don't realize how many jobs are here in town waiting for them. So we're trying to promote the notion that there's a lot of great and amazing innovative companies here, and we want people either to relocate here for the jobs or stay here and become part of the community.
Why do you think that it's important for the Phoenix area to have these kinds of jobs here?
Our joke is if in the 60s in the movie The Graduate, someone says go into plastics the future, I think today the future is either in coding or more specifically in cybersecurity. We see the attacks only going more sophisticated and more often. We know by the market that there's so many unfilled jobs. So it's quite obvious that we want to have a center here to help our area, our state, and also the companies that have started here.
Is there a particular reason why it's good for cybersecurity companies to be working here?
Yes. If you know, American Express placed a lot of their data centers here, and that is for a reason. Phoenix is the only metro area in the United States that doesn't have natural disasters. No flooding, no hurricanes, no earthquakes. So if you wanted to be heavily involved in data and in servers, this is a great place to set up your shop.
How big is the cybersecurity field in the Valley right now?
So we've done a survey just to see how big it is. We know there is at least 20 companies that that's what they do, and they're dedicated to that. However, when you look at any hospital, they should protect themselves from cybersecurity. Any company that manufactures weapons, for example, they need protection. So even if your company is not necessarily creating tools for cybersecurity, you still need that level of talent. So you have to think about it as most companies will need services that tie into cybersecurity.
Is the effort to attract and retain this kind of talent the same as for other tech-type jobs?
We don't think so. And let me tell you why. We are on a course to involve many mayors who realize that there's something very special about cybersecurity that is unlike the hospitality business, unlike nursing. And the reason is you can't really learn this stuff. There's not enough courses in any universities that will teach you what is happening right now. So the companies are really struggling to find talent that they can even train themselves and keep it. So it's not like we can go to just any other city in the United States and say, hey, come relocate to Scottsdale. When we're aiming our efforts, it's to specific hubs like Austin, like Silicon Valley, like New York, to bring people here because they might have those talents and the knowledge. Otherwise, there's nowhere else to get it.
What do you think is the ceiling for the cybersecurity industry in the Valley? I mean, do you think we could ultimately rival a place like Silicon Valley or Austin, places like that?
Absolutely. It is all about talent. It is not about where we started. It is how many great, amazing people can we bring here? And once it will become a cottage industry, we can get a virtuous cycle of growth. There is no reason for us to think we can't become the next great thing.
Ori Eisen is the founder of Trusona, which is a cybersecurity startup in Scottsdale. He's also on the board of Security Canyon, a cybersecurity coalition for Arizona. Ori, thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Tempe is in the process of looking for a new police chief. The city has narrowed its search down to 3 finalists, and officials are asking residents for their input. This week, Tempe held a public forum at which the 3 candidates took questions from residents. The public comment period ends tomorrow. For more on this, I'm joined by Nikki Ripley with the City of Tempe. And Nikki, has the city gotten much feedback?
The city manager, Andrew Ching, has, even before putting the job out to internal and external candidates, sought input internally and externally. This took place late summer, early fall. He invited police employees and other employees to talk to him about their feelings on the current state of and the direction of the department. And in addition, he hosted 2 community meetings in the September timeframe to ask residents the same sorts of things. What were their priorities for public safety in the community, and what did they think were the characteristics that a police chief in Tempe should possess?
What kinds of things did they say?
There were, in the public forums, expressions of feelings about community policing and the importance that that's played for them, particularly with neighborhood associations and homeowners associations. They've felt historically a connection to the police department and expressed that they would want to only see that enhanced and at least maintained. There were folks who expressed preferences for, you know, internal or external candidates. And so the city manager took all that and more in and used it in his decision so far.
One of the candidates is an internal candidate. The other 2 finalists are from outside. What kinds of things have you heard about the 3 people that one of whom will become the next chief?
The city is confident that the 3 folks who are advancing in the process are extremely qualified, have had amazing careers in public safety, and certainly all deserve to be where they're at in the process now.
Does the city know when it expects to name the next police chief?
The city manager is looking to make an announcement in the early part of this year. That may mean later this month. It may mean February. There's no set time frame.
Nikki Ripley with the City of Tempe. Nikki, thanks.
You bet.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, my name is Melanie Mandolin, and I'm out here shooting today as a new member of the Papago Archery Association Club. I like any kind of target thing. I used to play darts in a league, and I just wanted to get out and meet people and be outside and shoot at things. So.
Yeah, the wind will always catch your stabilizer. It's a pain.
Before, when I took the class, we shot at the 10 meter, which is the closest. My goal is to work up to 30 meters and beyond.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder than it looks, and I can't imagine trying to shoot my dinner. It's hard enough shooting a target.
That's Melanie Mandolin shooting with the Papago Archery Association. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org.
Coming up, Northern Italy comes to North Phoenix as a very special exhibit featuring some of the world's most fabled musical instruments heads our way this weekend.
I think it is a little bit of a game changer for sure. These are the kinds of things you would normally expect to be seen at the Metropolitan.
How 10 of the most exceptional violins on the planet made it from Italy's Val dei Famiglie to Arizona's Valley of the Sun just ahead. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody in Valley Traffic. I-10 westbound, the exit ramp at Queen Creek Road is restricted. Also on State Route 347 southbound, a crash at Riggs Road. Mostly sunny skies in the valley forecast for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 64 degrees. 67 is average. 66 was our high yesterday. It'll be partly cloudy tonight with overnight lows in the mid-40s. Partly cloudy again for tomorrow with a high of 62. More of the same right on through the weekend. Right now in Phoenix, sunny skies, 62 degrees at KJZZ at 235.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, supplying water to Arizona in an environmentally responsible way, from protecting forests and preserving habitat for wildlife to partnering to store water underground. Learn more at srpcares.com.
In KJZZ News at 2:37, during the Yuma Agriculture Water Conference held yesterday, officials from the Arizona Department of Water Resources and the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation discussed water rights and supply for Yuma agriculture. From the KJZZ Science Desk, Amanda Soliday reports.
One of the key messages of the presentation, Yuma's agricultural water rights are not threatened.
Because of the priority of the water here, they are very secure in the water resources coming to Yuma, even in a shortage.
That's Tom Bouchotsky. He's the director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources. The latest U.S. Bureau of Reclamation water level projections for Lake Mead show potential for shortages in the lower basin states as early as 2017. These estimates do not take into account this winter's precipitation, says Terry Fulp, director of the Bureau of Reclamation's Lower Colorado region. A shortage would trigger restrictions based on priority. Regardless of that, Bouchotsky says water users must invest in the long-term health of the river basin.
We are one state. We do have a statewide allocation of Colorado River water. We are all interconnected, and perhaps there's a role for Yuma to participate in drought contingency efforts.
These efforts include pilot fallowing programs, where farmers are paid to leave acres unplanted and conserve irrigation water. In Yuma, I'm Amanda Soliday.
Rex Condi is prepping a log to go under the knife at the Wine Glass Bar Sawmill just north of Sky Harbor. It's a big piece of lumber, and it'll likely become a piece of furniture. Condi says lots of people think Phoenix only has cactuses, but people who have come from elsewhere want trees in their yards.
Nurseries have tried to accommodate that and have found trees that are climated to this climate around the world and brought them here so people can have trees. And a lot of those trees have just gorgeous, beautiful hardwood in it that's suited for making fine furniture.
Condi and his partner and fellow retiree LeVar Smith started their mill about 2 years ago. It was about that time they realized most valley trees that came down because of storms or other reasons went to the landfill. Smith says that's a shame.
We didn't even know that all this hardwood was in the valley going to the dump. And there's four or five species here that only grow kind of here in Phoenix that come from all over the world. All of a sudden we found out all this wood going to the dump or being wasted.
So the two did some research and found a subculture here that goes around town looking for trees that have fallen down that they can make something out of. Silas Kyler is a woodworker and one of the people on the lookout for interesting lumber.
When you work with wood, you start to appreciate the details of the grain and the beauty of the different species. In an urban environment, there's so many species that I've never seen before as lumber. So you sometimes some of it's unknown potential, where I see a log and think, that could be really cool.
Kyler is also a videographer, and along with documentary filmmaker David Hildreth, is working on a film about this process of turning fallen trees into furniture called Felled. Hildreth says it's about potential.
Here was this wood that, you know, was really cool when it was a tree in somebody's front yard, and it meant a lot to them when it was in their front yard, but once it hit the ground after a storm, it was trash. It was worth nothing. You know, most of the tree was in the back of a truck, cut up for firewood when we got there.
Hildreth says this wood is more than trash. It could be a dining room table for a family, or a desk, or chair, or any number of other things. The movie tracks an Aleppo pine tree that came down in Tempe during the 2014 monsoon that's being turned into tables.
People throw logs and trees away all the time in urban areas. Anywhere from 3 to 4 billion board feet of trees that could produce lumber end up in a landfill.
This seems to be a trend that's catching on in the valley. The sawmill's LeVar Smith says there are a bunch of old-growth trees around town that are coming to the ends of their lives that'd be perfect for turning into furniture. Mesa resident Otto Schill had a couple of them, walnut trees, in his yard.
The tree was planted either by my grandfather or my great-grandfather, I'm not sure which, but they're probably over 100 years old. There were two trees.
Schill wants to make a dinette set or a desk with the wood. He says if you can't have the trees anymore, having furniture made from them is the next best thing.
I've spent a lot of time studying them and studying what they did and, you know, knowing the family history, and this is just an important part of that.
Every tree's different, and it's like opening a Christmas present.
LeVar Smith says you can't go into a home improvement store and buy this kind of wood. He also says much of the furniture being built now is not using this quality of lumber. He says what he and Condi are doing is a win-win. It helps create unique furniture and keeps valuable wood out of the landfill.
We're not in this for the money. We're just in this for the enjoyment of seeing the excitement about saving these trees and what people can do with them.
Smith's partner, Rex Condi, says this isn't just for people who want to turn their trees into a table. They'll also go out and pick up trees, mill them, and then sell the lumber to woodworkers. Condi says in those cases, they keep a log of where the tree came from and why it came down.
And when we sell some boards to somebody, we can give them that provenance. So if they have this beautiful mantle or something, they can tell their friends the history of that piece of wood.
Filmmaker David Hildreth says he's found that after storms, Craigslist is awash in trees people don't know what to do with. He says there are lots of people, both here and in other cities, trying to figure out how to make this process work better. Hildreth says in many cases, it's something people just haven't thought about, but makes sense to them once they do.
Most of us have like IKEA furniture, and there's nothing wrong with that. But people recognize quality still. Even though we all, you know, just kind of buy whatever's cheapest, I think there's still something out there that people want something that's quality, something that's well made. And this is a really economical way to do it.
Hildreth says so far there's no real industry around this process of turning fallen trees into furniture, but he's hopeful that'll change. The Wine Glass Bar sawmills Rex Condi and LeVar Smith say in a typical day, about 100 millable trees come down in Phoenix. Their mill can only handle about 5 or 6 of those. Smith says there are a few others doing this kind of work, but even if more started together, they still wouldn't be able to work with all of those trees. He says the goal is to eventually turn their mill over to someone younger who can do more with it. The film Felled is set to be released later this year.
Colleges and universities often attract attention and sometimes even donations for their graduation speakers, and a lot of those speakers are given honorary degrees or doctorates. Bill Cosby's recent scandal and subsequent legal problems have led to several universities, including Marquette and Brown, to rescind his honorary degrees. But in the changing world of higher education, why are the honorary degrees still passed out? With me to talk about that is Scott Jasek, who leads editorial operations for Inside Higher Ed. Scott, do universities have good reason to take away the honorary degrees if something scandalous happens, or can that be seen as something that happened in the past, doesn't really impact the school's reputation or any of its students?
Well, that's certainly an argument that many people make, that it's a decision at that time. And I certainly think most colleges and universities don't follow the news to say, oh, did we give so-and-so an honorary degree in 2002, and is this person now looking less favorable than maybe he or she once did? But there have been other cases where people have raised questions after the fact. Mugabe, the former African dictator, would be one such example. And there are also a lot of people who think that honorary degrees have become cheapened by giving them out too easily and without asking enough questions in the first place. Some think it really should be a very high honor. The reality is some colleges give them to a wealthy alum for whom there might be a donation in the works.
Is this in many ways about marketing and PR?
It's certainly that's part of it, in that they look good. And this is where some people say it devalues it. I don't know who first said this, but a funny thing I heard about honorary degrees once was, you know, Albert Einstein was a brilliant scientist, but they never thought he should be an honorary member of the Baseball Hall of Fame. It's not to say that people who are distinguished in other parts of society and life aren't good people, but an honorary degree, some would say, should convey not just excellence, but something that relates directly to the college. But again, you have lots of traditions. Many public universities, for instance, will give an honorary degree to a new governor the first year he or she is in office. Mm. And that's sort of expected, regardless of how scholarly or supportive of higher ed the governor is.
When you have students who've really been through the grind, let's say there are students who were partially on scholarship, they also had a job, and then it took them 5 or 6 years to get their degree. You know, is there any degree of resentment when it comes to that, saying, well, I really worked hard for my real degree, and here's a person who was great in another realm but not here, and yet we've decided, hey, let's give an honorary degree to this person?
I haven't heard that so much as you do hear mockery and questioning when somebody who has an honorary doctorate then starts calling themselves Dr. Jones or whatever the person's last name is. So if people try to pretend it's the real degree, they're going to get a lot of backlash because it's not a real degree. But again, students, if you look at what they're looking for with graduation, it tends to be more interest in having some famous, well-known figures up there than necessarily the greatest scholars.
Scott, finally, I'm wondering about trends as we see education changing. We see even more and more online students. Does that in any way take away the importance of the graduation ceremony? And in any way, would that dull the momentum for getting some big name for an honorary degree and a speech?
Well, that goes both ways. Some online institutions have been creating graduation ceremonies in person. And I think it's because the factors that may encourage somebody to enroll online don't necessarily mean they don't want the recognition and experience of an in-person graduation. It's also the case, of course, that many online graduate, students don't really care about graduation ceremony at all and just want their degree so they can advance their career. Most attention on graduate honorary degrees, graduation speakers, involves undergraduate institutions with traditional residential students and with parents who expect something on graduation day. I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. You could look at what's going on with Cosby right now and think, wow, colleges will really reconsider. I predict there'll be plenty of celebrity honorees again this year, and in time, sadly, one or more of them will seem less honorable than he or she seems today.
Scott Jasek of Inside Higher Ed.
Good afternoon. Happy Thursday. It's the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic, there's an incident on State Route 143 southbound at University Drive. Maybe you want to avoid that area if you can. Elsewhere, I-10 westbound, a bit south of the valley, the exit ramp at Queen Creek Road is restricted. It'll be sunny this afternoon. Look for a high of 64, a few degrees cooler than average, also a couple degrees cooler than yesterday. Partly cloudy skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-40s. Partly cloudy, 62 for a high tomorrow. It is 62 degrees right now at KJZZ at 250.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering a gourmet game plan with gridiron subs, party platters, USDA prime steaks, fresh-made guacamole, and craft beers. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
Think for a moment about all of the things you touch in a day, other than your smartphone or a keyboard. What do you touch that isn't related to technology, and how does that affect us? Industrial designer Paula Zuccotti has put together a book called Everything We Touch, a 24-hour inventory of our lives. It features 26 people from 11 cities and photographs of the objects they touched. Three of the 26 people are from Arizona. Paula Zuccotti joins me from London to tell us more. Paula, where did the idea come from?
Well, I'm a product designer myself, industrial designer. So for the last 15 years, I've been working on anticipating consumer behavior, what people want, and designing products accordingly. So I've been monitoring our interaction with objects for a little while all around the world, and I started to realize that our interaction with objects was changing, that there were things that we were not touching anymore, for instance. And I thought about capturing our interactions as they stand today, because many of the things we used to use now are becoming obsolete. For example, in the photos, we see that people don't touch music, they don't touch money, they don't touch alarm clocks.
Is there something we're missing by not having, I mean, I'm someone who loves to read books, and I still like to pick up, whether it's a paperback or a hardcover, as opposed to reading on some sort of electronic device. Are we missing something by missing out on that tactile experience?
I think it's a matter of personal taste, but what we are missing, for instance, is that desire to express ourselves through the things we touch. So I noticed how some of the people that I was interviewing were desperate to tell me, you know, what music they listened to and all those things that they couldn't show on their physical footprint.
How did Arizona become part of this project?
I was looking for people that were kind of different to what I see every day. So, you know, a cowboy may sound like a cliche, but I was going to, you know, I went to Japan and I wanted to see a geisha, and I went to China and I wanted to see a lion dancer. I was looking for those things that define cultures in a way. So I did a road trip in America from San Francisco to Los Angeles and from Los Angeles to Arizona. And on my last destination, I was looking for a cowboy. So I approached a cowboy at White Stallion Ranch near Tucson, and I photographed a day in his life. And I also did a day in the life of Adriana, who is a horse vet, and she used to run a stable in Saguaro Lake near Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And I also did a day in the life of Carlos, who is an IT consultant and marketing, who also is a mariachi.
So based on what they were touching, were they consistent with what you were finding in other things as far as what people were touching? It sounds like those would be more salt of the earth kind of people, and they would still be touching the things they've been touching or people in their profession have for decades.
Yes, it's amazing because, for example, with David, the cowboy from Tucson, he was saying that all the horseshoeing and the tools haven't changed for ages. So it's amazing to see how some professions are still relying on physical tools so much that are not affected so much by technology in a way.
Paul, I wonder if you'd mind sharing with us, based on your work as an industrial designer and just as a human being, what are some of the things that you touch, and were you conscious of those things, touching them every day?
Yes, now I am much more. That level of consciousness was something that arises from the exercise, and it also happened to the people that I interview. They all talk about mindfulness and learning a little bit more about themselves by seeing their life in front of them. And I am conscious of things as well. It kind of like makes you think about the things that you don't need, or the things that are more essential, or the things that you really treasure.
And how did people define themselves based on objects? Do you define yourself based on the objects you touch on a daily basis?
Yes, I think so. But the nice thing about it is, like, if I, let's look at it that way. I'm somebody that likes, you know, what I wear and my accessories, and, you know, like to dress in a certain way. And I would think that that's how I define myself, and I would be really conscious of my choices and what I buy. And, you know, so many people are like that. But that's just one side of us, the one that we can control, and we can use to express ourselves. But when you do this exercise and you put together everything you touch, it's a much more honest reflection of who you are. It's a kind of more truth x-ray. So if you put, I don't know, my nice sunglasses next to my tea towel, my, you know, fork and knife, and all those things, suddenly they will give you a much more honest x-ray of my day than what I would like people to see.
We've been talking with Paula Zuccotti. Her book is called Everything We Touch, A 24-Hour Inventory of Our Lives, and some of the amazing photos include people from Arizona. Paula, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you so much, Steve. It was great talking to you.
Northern Italy is coming to North Phoenix as a very special exhibit featuring some of the world's most fabled musical instruments heads to Arizona this weekend. KJZZ's Phil Latzman explored the story behind how 10 of the most exceptional violins on the planet made it from the Val di Fiemme to the Valley of the Sun.
These are the sweet sounds of the Stradivarius as performed by violin virtuoso Joshua Bell. It's one of the rarest and most valuable musical instruments in the world, and soon 10 of them will be on display right here in the Valley, a new exhibit starting this weekend at the Musical Instrument Museum.
We are extraordinarily fortunate to have this exhibition here. It certainly speaks to our mission.
That's April Salomon, MIM's executive director, who believes the Stradivarius exhibit marks an important milestone in the museum's six-year existence.
I think it is a little bit of a game changer for sure. These are the kinds of things you would normally expect to be seen at the Metropolitan and other obviously very well-known institutions around the country and the world for that matter.
The one-of-a-kind exhibition brings a collection of the timeless masterpieces ranging from 500 years old to modern versions together in one space and takes us all the way back to 16th century Italy to hear how the modest city of Cremona shaped musical history.
You will be brought to the magical town of Cremona. And you'll be walked through the life of a violin and the many hands that it passes through, the hands of a master maker, the hands of a musician.
As MIM's curator for Europe, Kathleen Weens, helped bring the unique instruments to Phoenix after a journey that stretched 2 years and 5,900 miles.
2 years ago, I made my first visit to the Museo del Violino in Cremona. They look on musical instruments in a very similar way that we do, in terms of that they're interested in the life of these instruments and the people who made them and the legacy that they've created.
While in Italy, Weens met with Paolo Bodini. He's the former mayor of Cremona and now president of Friends of Stradivari, an international organization whose mission is to bring together those who possess or use the rare violins believed to have been first made in his hometown.
One of our purposes is also to promote violin making and to make Cremona more known in the world. So this we thought was a very good chance.
So the 10 violins were carefully packed and shipped to Phoenix. The exhibit includes a 1728 model on display for the very first time in the U.S. It was made by the man considered the master of the violin and its namesake, Antonio Stradivari.
He certainly was the best maker, you know, ever. He had a very particular way of choosing the type of wood, making the varnish, a very wonderful handcraft, and the sound is very special.
That's because the wood used to make the stringed masterpiece comes from only one small part of the world, the forest in the Italian Alps that surrounds Bodini's ancient city of Cremona.
The spruce tree, which is the sound wood, you know, the tone wood of the top of the violin, that is grows only in a couple of valleys in the Alps near the Dolomites, Val di Fiemme, and only 10% of this wood is good enough to make the tone wood for violin.
That makes them the rarest of the rare, with some worth more than $1 million each. Visitors to MIM will not only see and hear the Stradivarius version, but also those handcrafted by Andrea Amati, the 16th century maker considered the father of the violin, and the rogue genius of the strings, Guarnieri del Gesù. Special opening weekend activities at MIM include concerts featuring some of the world's most talented modern violinists, including virtuosas Rachel Barton Pine and Regina Carter. Stradivarius, Origins, and Legacy of the Greatest Violin Maker will be on display at the museum until June 5th. In North Phoenix, Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
Make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 for the show. We'll look at where TV, media, and real life meet in the effort to overturn wrongful convictions and unwrapping a new exhibit from a Renaissance master in Phoenix. Those stories and a whole lot more tomorrow at 2 on the show.
And if you're looking for stuff to do tonight, you might want to join Mark Ilsa Brody for Disney on Ice Frozen.
That's Elsa, Steve.
Oh, God.
Elsa.
See, when you don't have kids, you don't know stuff, Mark. I'm sorry.
You can also check out ASU taking on Washington State men's basketball tonight at Wells Fargo Arena in Tempe.
And the Dave Rawlings Machine plays tonight at 7:30 at the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Regina Revizova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. News director Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
For Elsa and Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is KJZZ-FM Phoenix in HD at 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, offering full-time, part-time, online, and executive MBA programs. You can get an inside look at MBA Preview Day Thursday, January 14th. Registration at mbapreviewday.com.